Alabama voters head to the polls in less than 3 weeks. They'll pick a governor, members of the cabinet, and a lot of state House and Senate seats. One thing that may stick out on the ballot is that many of the candidates are women. Glamour magazine published an article on the 18 African-American Alabama women running in the midterms. APR's Pat Duggins reports on the campaigns of another 23 female candidates on the ballot in Alabama, which are being fueled by a statewide initiative.
I'd like to welcome you all to our Labor Day Festival today. I hope everybody has a good time.
It's Labor Day at the headquarters of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in Birmingham. A picnic's been set up out back with an inflatable water slide for the kids, hamburgers and hot dogs on the grill, and another holiday staple.
How are you?
I am well. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
I'm Jen Gray.
Yes, we mean politics. Candidates for public office, including circuit judge and county sheriff, are pressing the flesh. That includes Jen Gray.
I'm just me all the time, and that's all I know how to be.
She's running for Alabama State House District 45.
So I just go out and I say what I'm thinking about, and I talk to people about what's on my mind.
Gray is running against Republican incumbent Dickie Drake. APR made two calls to Drake's office for an interview. Those calls went unanswered. As for Jen Gray, she's a Democrat and a woman running in a state that votes mostly Republican and more often than not for male candidates.
Absolutely, yeah.
Gray agrees with some counts that puts the legislature at 85% men, and that's why she's running. Her message to the guys currently holding office in Montgomery is that Alabama needs more of a woman's perspective.
I know you think that you're doing everything the right way, but that's just because you don't know about these other things. You would change your mind if you knew that other people thought about it differently.
For example, Gray championed the idea of using campaign funding to pay for child care.
If you're a single parent, if you're a woman that is responsible for that child care, I can't leave my child in the car watching YouTube videos while I go in and talk to a mayor.
Gray says that idea left many men in Alabama government scratching their heads, and it could be one of the reasons getting women like Gray to run for office has been tricky.
You know, you ask a man to run, he says, sure, I know I'm qualified, I'm sure I am.
That's Stacey Probst. She's with the newly formed group Emerge Alabama.
A woman needs a little encouragement. She's already got 25 jobs, usually unpaid and underpaid. And then on top of that, you want to layer on public service.
A phone call was made to the national group Emerge America to possibly set up a branch in Alabama to cultivate female progressive candidates like Jen Gray. Probst says it wasn't easy.
Well, yes, there was an initial thought. The first phone call, they were saying, well, we're not quite ready to expand into the South, the Deep South. Right.
Which makes sense in Red Alabama. But then there was a follow-up call.
And said, no, we've changed our minds. We want to go full force on a 50-state strategy.
So I'm going to go over just some basics, kind of get discussion of what everybody's doing.
And that phone call led to this.
So with phone banking or your general once-a-week volunteer thing, are you guys doing that?
Jen Gray and about a dozen other female candidates, all enlisted by Emerge Alabama, are getting a refresher course on how to run a political campaign. Instructor Kayla Sloan is using a PowerPoint presentation on things like how to get volunteers, how to conduct polls, and so on.
Yeah, good. Always reshift your volunteers, yeah.
Probst says the point is to get past the red state, blue state mentality and focus on the basics.
Look at who votes. Look who doesn't vote. Look who's not registered. Study your communities, and then get out there and talk to people. It's really not that complicated.
Emerge Alabama wants to turn female voters toward more progressive candidates. There are estimates that 51% of Alabama's voters are women. One event in December of last year proved how potent that voting bloc can be.
I have, over the last years of my career, fought for civil rights. I have fought for women's rights. I have fought.
Stacey Probst says that when Democrat Doug Jones beat Roy Moore for the U.S. Senate, a lot of people working for the campaign and a lot of people who voted for Jones were women. Probst says her goal is to keep that going.
I have lots and lots of women friends who I grew up with right here in Alabama who say they're Republican, but they're not.
And Probst wants to flip those GOP voters.
If you have 5 seconds with them to talk about the issues, turns out they care about exactly the same things that all of our candidates care about. Families, health care, good jobs, good education. They all want the same things that most women want.
Should we really say, well, Alabama is going to turn blue anytime soon? Probably not.
Dr. Regina Wagner is an assistant professor of political science at the University of Alabama. Her healthy skepticism is fueled by her research, which focuses on women in politics.
So I think you have some room to win sort of the squishy center, but there is a limit to that just because there are some people who that is just a line for them that they aren't going to cross. And some of them are women, and so I don't think you can win over these women. But I think there are some women you can win over.
So we didn't go to these homes that were like, they clearly had voted Republican.
Back in class, Heather Milam speaks up. She's running for Secretary of State. She recalls a situation while campaigning door-to-door for Democrat Doug Jones' run for the U.S. Senate. It turns out turning GOP women can get dicey, and one reason for that are their GOP husbands.
It was a very interesting day. 10% of the homes, the men answered the door and would not let us speak to their wives, even though we were asking specifically to talk to the woman.
Emerge Alabama has 23 women on the ballot this November. So once Election Day is over, what represents success to Stacey Probst? She puts it this way.
I want every woman and every little girl to be seeing this. Look at those candidates. They look like me. I want to run for office in the future. How do I get there? How do I plan for that?
Back at the Electricians Union picnic, the hamburgers are just about done.
We're not doing a real good job, I don't think, investing our money right now. That's part of the reason that I am running for office.
But Jen Gray isn't. She continues shaking hands and making small talk with voters, knowing that she's made a bit of headway already. Remember her point about using campaign dollars for childcare? Earlier this year, the Alabama Ethics Commission voted to allow that. It's not a victory at the ballot box, but a woman's perspective did win the day on that one issue. Pat Duggins, APR News, in Birmingham.
The state of Alabama has a long and complicated history with the Ten Commandments from the Old Testament of the Bible. This Election Day, voters will decide if that relationship will continue as is. APR's Stan Ingold has more on the ballot item known as Amendment 1.
Woe unto thee, O Israel! You have sinned a great sin in the sight of God. You are not worthy to receive these Ten Commandments.
When actor Charlton Heston delivered the Ten Commandments in the 1956 Cecil B. DeMille movie classic, his Moses didn't seem interested in politics.
Hey, there is no freedom without the law.
Whose law, Moses? Yours?
2,000 years later, here in Alabama, things are different.
I've been working on this off and on for about 14 years.
That's State Senator Gerald Dial. He's the author of Senate Bill 181 that eventually became Amendment 1 on the upcoming ballot. This will allow the display of the Ten Commandments in a constitutional manner on public property. It's just the latest legislative attempt to do so. Dial says the political climate is better this time around.
We've had a dynamic shift in the makeup of the legislature, both the House and the Senate, a majority of the Republicans in the House and the Senate, so we just felt like we were very fortunate.
I spoke with Dial as he was cleaning out his office in the State House after 35 years in the Alabama Senate. Dial says some goodwill from his colleagues may have helped overcome some concerns about legislating religion.
I kindly leaned on him and said, hey, I won't be back. Let's do this. I may have gotten a few sympathy votes to make this a priority. Not that the bill is not a priority, but sympathy that, hey, we need to pass Senator Dial's bill. It's his last time and he'd like to do this, and he's been persistent on this.
This constitutional amendment could cause some problems. That's the view of Randall Marshall. He's the executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Alabama. Marshall says some people may not fully understand the amendment.
I think the effect of this amendment is actually going to be to invite litigation against school districts that post the Ten Commandments standing alone, thinking that somehow they're allowed to do so now.
Marshall adds that this amendment doesn't do anything new.
There is a provision in there, though, that says, provided they're posted in a constitutional manner. Therein lies the rub, because the amendment doesn't provide anything that's not already lawful. If a school can post the Ten Commandments in a constitutional manner, there's nothing to prevent it from doing so now.
However, Senator Dial disagrees.
Because if it's in our Constitution, they're following the laws of the state of Alabama, then if you've got problem with that Ten Commandments being in a city hall, and you've got to sue the state of Alabama to change our constitution. So it relieves that legal responsibility from those people who might want to put the Ten Commandments in.
And Marshall says that is not the case.
That's clearly wrong. From a legal standpoint, and I am a lawyer, he's just flat wrong on that. There would be no obligation to sue the state. And in fact, you don't have a cause of action against the state. You have a cause of action against the school district that's operating in an unconstitutional manner.
And these fights can get expensive, costing hundreds of thousands up into the millions of dollars in legal fees. Senator Dial says there's a provision that prohibits the use of public funds to defend the constitutionality of this amendment.
We've had outside sources, not only from in-state, out-state, who have stepped up and volunteered and said, we will hire their attorneys and we will pay their cost and we will take this through the process.
Marshall has doubts about that, too.
What the senator is missing is that no outside organization is going to come in and say, not only will we defend you, but we will pay the other side's attorney's fees if we lose. There's no organization out there that will do that. And so that's why a school district would still be on the hook for potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Someone who spent a lot of time on the losing end of fights over the Ten Commandments in Alabama is former Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore.
Well, I displayed them in Supreme Court in 2001, I believe it was. And by 2003, there had been a complaint filed with the Federal District Court, which ordered the Ten Commandments removed.
An Alabama ethics panel kicked Roy Moore out as Chief Justice in 2003 for refusing to remove a Ten Commandments monument from the lobby of the state judicial building.
It was a legal fight. Most people think it was just a religious fight. It was about the acknowledgement of God. It wasn't about the display of the Ten Commandments. That was made clear by the Federal District Court. It said the question was, can the state acknowledge God? And he said no. And I submit to you, the state does acknowledge God in many ways, in law.
Moore says the state's relationship with the Ten Commandments is still complicated.
Of course, I've been a long supporter of the Ten Commandments. And as you know, there's a history about displaying the Ten Commandments in the Supreme Court of Alabama, which, by the way, they're still displayed there, only in a different form. They put them in a historical context. And, you know, after I was removed from office for displaying the monument of the Ten Commandments, they put them in the Capitol.
Now it's up to the voters to decide the fate of Amendment 1. If it does pass, one of the key factors is to remember that the Ten Commandments, if posted, must be done in a constitutional manner. Randall Marshall thinks many people may not understand that.
I think it's inevitable. I would hope before either a school district or some other governmental entity does it, that they get good counsel, because the clearest violation that's going to get somebody in one of those entities in trouble would be to just all by itself put up the Ten Commandments.
For APR News, I'm Stan Ingold in Montgomery.
The midterm elections are tomorrow, but political observers will likely tell you that many of the races were really decided back in June during the party primaries. Alabama is one of the reddest states in the country. Republicans currently hold every statewide elected position and supermajorities in both chambers of the legislature. But what does party affiliation and identity really mean in Alabama? And how does the party structure work? APR's Alex Aubuchon has more.
Two wides left, two to the right, including Devontae Smith, who's in motion.
The two-party structure in American politics lends itself to a lot of tidy analogies, like, for example, a football game.
Opening passes and a touchdown! Jerry Jeudy!
I'm outside Bryant-Denny Stadium in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, for the homecoming game between the Crimson Tide and the Missouri Tigers. As tens of thousands of fans waited to head in to cheer on their team, I asked who they'd be supporting. Not between the Tide and the Tigers, but between the Republicans and the Democrats in November.
I am a Republican, and I will vote straight Republican.
Pam Fitch of Auburn, Alabama, knows how she's voting. Others, not so much.
Well, party-wise, I'm a Republican. But political ideology, it kind of ranges to both. I think now the parties are kind of shifting.
That's Joe Wheeler of Tuscaloosa. And as for Nia Miller of Hoover,
party affiliation is not very important to me, but ideology is. Yeah. What the candidates are saying or not saying.
These somewhat squishy answers on political leanings might have something to do with the unusual way political parties work in Alabama.
Alabama is a no-party registration state.
That's political commentator Steve Flowers.
When you register to vote in most states, you register as either a Republican, a Democrat, or independent. Alabama is a no-party state, no registration, which means you can be a Republican today and a Democrat tomorrow.
But more practically, it could just about be called a one-party state.
There are 29 elected statewide officials in Alabama. Now, granted, 12 of them are judicial posts, but all 29 elected statewide officials are Republicans.
Terry Lathan is the head of Alabama's Republican Party. She explains what exactly her organization does.
We wear many hats, to tell you the truth. We have a real strong infrastructure. We have a very powerful GOP database with our voters in it, and that gives us a lot of information. We share this information with our candidates, which in turn helps their campaigns. We also push out the content and the messaging of the platform of the Republican Party. So if you mix all that up, we are very, very busy people in this state.
One would expect the state party on the Democratic side to be similar, and in theory it is. But Chris England, state representative for Alabama's 70th district in Tuscaloosa County, says that's not how it really works.
They do nothing. Absolutely nothing. Most Democratic candidates run despite the party because if, you know, whenever you talk to somebody who's planning on running as a Democrat and you ask them, if you're interested in running, you have to just tell them up front that the Democratic Party will not help you. They're incapable of it. There's no leadership, and you're pretty much on your own.
England went on to elaborate on what it is the state party doesn't do.
I mean, if you look at it right now, they don't even maintain, they don't make a consistent social media presence. They don't do any fundraising. They don't really do any candidate recruitment, and you don't really see anybody complaining about it.
I repeatedly asked Alabama Democratic Party Chair Nancy Worley and Alabama Democratic Conference member Joe Reed for comment. Both declined to be interviewed. Steve Flowers says for the vast majority of Alabama's political history, the power balance was very different.
We were a totally Democratic state. That doesn't mean we were Democratic like the rest of the New York Democrats or California Democrats. We just, out of tradition, ran as Democrats. Well, when that changed in the 60s and 70s and 80s, we made an about-face and became a totally Republican state.
And the result?
The party just atrophied.
Democrat Chris England.
And as the apathy increased, the expectations of leadership decreased. And when you put somebody in office who's basically just kind of sitting there with no expectations, we don't pay them and we get what we pay for, essentially.
Terry Lathan says not getting paid doesn't bother her too much.
I'm a 42-year volunteer. I just turned 60, but I've been 42 years volunteering in the Republican Party. I've never taken a paycheck. I still don't. I work 40 hours a week for something I love. We don't do that for money. We do that. All our folks are volunteers because we believe in the cause, the bigger cause.
Democratic House member Chris England says despite the dysfunction he sees in the state Democratic Party, he thinks there's still an energized base of support in Alabama. He points to last December as an example.
We were very effective in the Doug Jones election, for example, in communicating through various means, whether it be social media, print media, radio ads, and so forth, outside of the Democratic Party structure, to get the word out, to get people to the polls.
Steve Flowers warns against putting too much stock in Doug Jones' election win.
The Jones situation was a complete anomaly. It will probably never happen again in 100 years.
But Chris England isn't so sure.
You know, obviously that was a very unique circumstance with a very, very flawed Republican candidate. But we created a number of new voters. And if we can capture those numbers again and bring them out and increase them a little bit, I think we can prevail on November 6th.
On the Republican side, Terry Lathan isn't willing to sleep on her advantage.
My number one concern always is not that we don't have the money, not that we don't have the content or the policy or really great candidates. It's complacency that people will say, oh, they've got everything. Oh, I don't need to go vote. You know, they're going to win. The Republicans are going to win anyway. What difference does it make?
She comes back to that football analogy, looking at the Crimson Tide.
Champions get up every day thinking, what can I do better? How can I run faster? What can I do to improve? You know, gosh, I made a mistake last time. What can I do to fix that? And so I like to apply that to the political world too. I get up every day thinking like that. I don't get up thinking, yay, we have it all. I can take today off. I think that's a mistake. And so I plan to keep us at the top of our game.
Timeout? No. Bama's going to watch and reposition some players. Drew Locke under pressure. Drew Locke for the second time is sacked by the Alabama Crimson Tide.
The University of Alabama's football team is at the top of its game. The team trounced Missouri at homecoming 39-10. And if the pundits and the party analysts are right, you'll likely see a different team of elephants with similar margins of victory following tomorrow's vote. I'm Alex Aubuchon, APR News in Tuscaloosa.